This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, Ti Xiao Yik. If you think your child is the only one who has become more fussy or problematic with routines like eating, sleeping, and other daily habits, think again. More children have been experiencing feeding problems, sleep disruptions, even increased anxiety, and it's not just due to the pandemic alone. Consultant developmental pediatrician Dr. Rajini Savarnandan joins me today to enlighten us on why these issues may be worsening for some children and, of course, what parents can do. Thanks for joining me today, Dr. Rajini. So I know that you did mention to me that it has been your observation that some children are struggling more with these routines now. Their parents are struggling together with them as well, of course. So what exactly have you been seeing?
You know, even prior to the pandemic, we were starting to get more referrals of children having sleep issues, having feeding problems, difficulty settling into their schools or preschools. And, you know, it was starting to become more concerning even before the pandemic itself. I think, you know, if you look, the WHO recognizes this and also came up with the nurturing development for in childhood. And that one of the reasons for that was to do with issues in children increasing. I know we always talk about mental health issues in teenagers, and it's been highlighted particularly in the last few years, even in Malaysia before the pandemic. But if we look at these mental health issues in our adolescents, it actually goes back down to when they were infants, toddlers, and it didn't just miraculously happen as teenagers. I know there's a lot of blame game on social media, but that's just one factor. And actually, we look, a lot of these children probably had issues when they were much younger, but it went unnoticed.
And so, you know, these issues that you talked about, especially related to eat, sleep, you know, difficulty settling, you're talking about those younger ages than those formative ages where these issues are manifesting, but, you know, we are not thinking of them as certain concerns.
Yeah, we're not talking about children who may have a disorder, but we're just talking about children who probably are struggling with some of these basic needs that children have as infants and toddlers and even young children, but may actually, their problems actually surface much later. Yeah. And when we talk about, you know, people always say, you know, how does it affect children? It's all to do with the brain and how it develops and how it gets used to certain environments, certain routines, etc. And if we take feeding, for example, shall we? There are a lot of feeding issues that we see in adults with, when they're not feeding issues, but when we talk about non-communicable diseases, and we look at diet, for example, as being one of the factors. If you look back, many of them probably had issues with their feeding, their nutritional intake from very young as toddlers. And, you know, it's a whole cycle. We know, for example, mothers who are picky with their food in pregnancy and don't expose their fetuses to a variety of foods in pregnancy, that may also impact your palate as you get older. Similarly, a breastfeeding mother who has a very restricted diet, we often see that their children are picky eaters as well. You know, and it's the food choices you give when children are young that sort of affect them throughout childhood. Now, some children actually improve into adulthood, but a lot of in a lot of conditions, even if we're talking about heart disease, etc., the problems are already there in adolescence.
So that puts a lot of pressure on mothers, but it is something that has been talked about for a long time. But you know, Dr. Rajini, I also hear a lot of, from parents, especially mothers, who, well, they don't feel that they were restrictive in their own practices, right? And they do all the things that every single parenting book will tell you. And yet, their kids are struggling with, and I think fussy eating is probably something that's, you hear this narrative a lot. Are some kids perhaps predisposed to these problems?
I think if you look generally across the board, all children, and it's also understanding what is normal development, because if you don't understand it, you then do put undue pressure on yourself and on your child in trying to get them to eat. Let's just take nutritional intake, for example. When we start to introduce complementary feeding at, 4 to 6 months, babies are like little sponges. You know, they often will open their mouths to try new things, or they may be a little bit reluctant if the taste is new, but with lots of little tries, they eventually do. And they go through a phase where they actually eat quite, they start to eat more in terms of quantity. But then comes toddlerhood. And in toddlerhood, the actual amount of food that a toddler consumes actually reduces. And this is where parents don't understand that. They start to get anxious because they feel their child is becoming underweight because they're not eating. And then they start to force feed, or they start to maybe give more rice, less of the other stuff, because they want the kids to, get bigger again. We have to understand, as children start to move more, all that little baby fat starts to reduce and they become leaner as their muscles build up. So, if you don't understand that, you may be force feeding your child. You may be actually killing that sort of satiety, that feeling of fullness, etc. And you're predisposing your children to obesity. Yeah. And the same way with sleep. Yeah. As children move from infancy to toddlerhood, some children regress with their sleep. Yeah, this battle of wanting to be independent, being awake, exploring the world takes over. And so naps become half an hour during the day, but maybe they start to sleep through the night. So, but at the same time, when they start to have nightmares, they start waking up at night. So, and parents take that the wrong way and think that their child is hungry and start to feed them in the middle of the night again, which is really a no-no by the time you're a toddler. So it's these misconceptions of what normal development is that sometimes results in a lot of anxiety as well.
All right. So what I want to find out then is, because of normal developmental phases, you're saying that there are ups and downs. The routines go through different paces. But then you are also saying that some of these regressions are getting worse. The disruptions are getting worse. So, how much of it is normal? How do we know when then, to be concerned? That's something we will come back to discuss with Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician. We're discussing disruptions to daily routines like eating, sleeping, and how this could be linked to increased anxiety among children. Stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik. Joining me on the show today, Dr. Rajini Sarvanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician. Is your child suddenly, becoming fussier at eating, having more difficulty sleeping? Are you pulling your hair out because of these issues? Dr. Rajini has, said that she's been seeing children struggling with these. And it's not just because of the pandemic, which is something that I think many parents, instinctively linking it to the effects of lockdown, school closures, and all the disruptions in routines. But, there are a lot of issues that actually tie back to the poor mothers who, we as parents, as new mothers, we read about this, how important it is for our own lifestyles to be healthy when we're expecting our child throughout pregnancy, as well as during the breastfeeding and all the habits that we nurture during complementary feeding while helping children to learn healthy sleep habits and all of that. And of course, Dr. Rajini, you've also explained that children go through developmental phases. So sleep patterns change, eating, the amount that they eat, perhaps the way that they approach eating changes as their personality develops. So when do parents know when to be concerned then? To identify that it's reached a level that's perhaps not normal and cause for concern?
I think, you know, when you're starting to see that your child is becoming distressed for whatever reason, parents go, when they look at nutrition, they look at weight and height. And yes, we do. We can plot our children's weight on, you know, many families have these little books, the ones from the government, as well as the ones that are given out by private clinics, where you chart your child's growth. So that can be an early indication that your child's not getting the right nutrition. And if, for example, things like sleep patterns are being affected. Yeah, your child is waking up extremely often after a period of time where they were actually sleeping through the night. Behaviors, so if your child goes to a nursery or daycare, they may start to see that your child is having more tantrums, for example, if you're talking about toddlers. Yeah. And remember, an anxious toddler or an anxious preschooler may not always be hiding behind their parents or clinging on to them. They may actually be acting out in certain situations. For example, as mealtime is approaching or they start to see mom getting out utensils, et cetera, they start to throw a tantrum because they've associated that with the stress of eating. They've not enjoyed it at all. So seeing some of these should alert parents that there is a problem. And I think, you know, I know we keep saying it's mothers, but it's not only mothers. It's also the other people around the child that the child sees eating, what they do on their day-to-day also affects a child's development. So, you know, when we talk about the nurturing care framework, one of the things it says is it's about raising the child with the within a community rather than that family, nucleus family alone.
And you do hear this, right? Other caregivers in the family, and it could be helpers or grandparents or other family members living in the family household. And of course, the fathers as well, who may introduce different things and routines, and it may not necessarily achieve the same objective.
Yeah, and I think this is where we need to understand that really for things like sleeping, meal times, toddlers and young children especially, they do better when there's a routine around it. Yeah. And, you know, if there are going to be changes in a routine, if it's spelt out in some way beforehand, that helps. But generally, toddlers thrive around sleep and feeding routines. Yeah. And the same way we see that, you know, they start to pick up on our movements and our cues. Many a time you will see that, you know, you don't have to tell a child that you're going out. But if you start to change from, you know, your shorts and t-shirt, or a mother starts to put on her tudung, the child starts to pick up, aha, mommy's going out. So it's time for me to get ready, or for me to make a fuss so that she takes me out with her. You know, so you can see that children are observing our behaviors, and hence why having that routine gives that child an idea. So pre-meal, pre-bedtime routines gives that child an idea of what's coming. Then you don't have that battle of stopping the child in the middle of a play activity or in the middle of the program that they're watching, etc. Yeah.
And many of us, I think, are now guilty of looking around us to gauge what the benchmark should be. You know, we see on social media, other kids, their parents are putting up posts that the kids are eating, you know, these beautifully prepared homemade meals. It looks so balanced. And if my child's not doing that, then I'm not doing it right. Or, you know, stories about how well-behaved they are at school, things like that, right? And I just wonder, how do we, and we know we shouldn't be doing that, but how do we gauge what is right or wrong when it comes to our children's own individual habits?
We always say do what is right for you, but ensuring that your child is given the right opportunity. Yeah. Okay. Sadly, yes, social media, you know, social media, people need to know that social media only portrays things that are perfect and wonderful sometimes, especially when it comes to parenting. And we all know we have those tear your hair moments, regardless, you know, you may have the most perfect child, but you have those moments with your children. If you don't, I'd be worried. I would say that what we have in terms of expectations should be according to what works for us and our family, and not strive to be what someone else does. You know, it's so hard to live up to expectations, right? We as adults know that in our work, you know, in our life as we've grown to become where we are now. Can you imagine that if we put that pressure on a very young child to live up to, so we, you know, we create this beautiful meal for your child, and then your child comes and is like splatting it everywhere, you lose it sometimes, because you've spent that time and your expectation is my child is going to eat that. Oh, it looks so wonderful. But that doesn't happen. What happens then is you lose it, or you start to put pressure on your child to eat it, and force feeding starts. And then that child starts to have that negative experience, and it only takes one negative experience. And then you to undo it takes so much longer. Okay. So I think we have to be very mindful of what works for us as a family. Yeah. And there's no right or wrong way, but as long as you're giving your child that right opportunities and your expectation is matching what is appropriate at that age.
Are there certain challenges that might be different for non-typically developing children?
Yes, and that's why we often say that, you know, it's important to be aware. So, for example, it's of course easier if you know when your child is born that your child will be non-typically developing, because then hopefully you have the right information about what you need to do. If you take, for example, a baby who is born with a cleft lip and palate, okay, so their feeding from birth will be challenging. And we know many of them will find breastfeeding difficult, let alone feeding from a bottle with a normal teat. So then there are specially designed bottles to help babies establish that sucking at the early stages before they can move on to breastfeeding, etc. And if you take, for example, a baby who has been born with Down syndrome, you know, we know, for example, that their muscle tone is going to be more floppy, and as such, you know, sitting up to feed may be a problem. You know, we always say when you start with giving your babies complementary feeding, you want them sitting propped up in a well-supported seat, and you know that they can hold their heads up. But a child with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy, they may be slower with their motor skills, but it doesn't mean you delay feeding until they get to those motor skills. So having those having the knowledge of what is wrong with your child early on helps. It's harder for children whom we don't expect that there is going to be a problem. So we know there are children who have sensory aversions, yeah? Or, for example, if we take children who have autism, and many of them have issues with sleep and being picky. And very often, if we look back into infancy, a lot of the problems may have started there itself. Yeah. So I would say that if, as a parent, you're struggling very early on, it doesn't mean we're going to label your child straight away, but you get help because maybe there need to be modifications that have to happen. For example, we need to do a lot more sensory play a lot earlier when children are averse to touching something that's sticky or wet. You know, it's very natural that children, as they develop, start to take things and put things in their mouth, regardless what it is. Yeah. But if from a very young age they're averse to touching something, then we've got to do things to try and help them desensitize that sensation.
What might be some other red flags that could indicate these issues that are less apparent, right? For example, sensory aversions. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to then their eating routines, what would be some of the behaviors they might display?
So some children who have sensory aversions start to gag when they smell of seafood. And if they're starting to do that in infancy, so from 6 months onwards, that is a warning sign, yeah? Or if they have been eating very well, but then it regresses, like I said, amounts reduce, children start to become fussy, they expect that they start to eat more adult food, but we still give them something that's soft and slimy, they start to reject it. That's normal. However, if your child is rejecting everything across the board, then you know you need to seek help. Yeah. So gagging, like I said, refusal to get messy and touch things, a refusal to, or think kids who don't put things in their mouth. Children between 4 months and 18 months are mouthing. That's normal. Yeah. So if they are not doing that, that's another warning sign when it comes to a sensory aversion. Or they become extremely distressed by certain sounds, or maybe if you go to the beach, the first day they don't like it, but you know, for kids with sensory aversions, regardless of how many days you stay there, they never get used to being on the beach or, you know, touching things that are sticky, slimy, etc. Children who are fussy about clothes, for example, they don't want to wear particular materials, or they don't like long sleeve, short sleeve, etc. So these are little things that you need to watch out for if we're talking about sensory aversions. Mm-hmm. But we also have to remember, we as parents play a role in the sensory development. So when, you know, there's a tendency nowadays for parents to want to have minimal mess, to have clean environment. So they don't let their children get messy and dirty. They don't allow their children to run around barefoot or pick up stones, etc. And all this is actually hindering sensory development. You may actually be causing problems.
COVID has probably made things worse, right?
Yeah, and I think we're seeing a doubling or tripling of children with issues because of COVID, you know, ranging from sleep issues, because children are being confined in their homes with parents who are working. And I mean, even before COVID, you know, we have kids who go to nurseries or to babysitters. And if there's no outdoor playtime, these children are being ferried in cars before the sun rises. They go into an apartment or they go into a nursery which has no outdoor facility. They're indoors and, you know, there are shades down, air conditioning on. And then when the parents pick them up, it's sunset. So children don't have that, you know, they're not exposed to that daylight. So the brain forgets. Yeah. And that affects sleep routines as well. And more so with COVID when parents were stuck at home, right? Because before that, at least parents were driving in their cars, going to nurseries or to daycares. And suddenly with COVID, everybody was at home. So we, for about 2 years, some children didn't leave the house. They didn't even step out of the front door.
And I'm curious though, you did say that these were already showing up or and were concerning even before the pandemic. Why would that have been?
I think our lifestyles, especially, you know, in the cities, have changed. Yeah. It's now impossible if you don't have two parents working. So what then happens to children? Children get sent into childcare. And if we don't have good quality childcare facilities, then that affects how a child develops. Yeah. I feel that's one issue. Number two, and I think this has been shown by a lot of studies worldwide, looking at maternal mental health, right? And maternal nutrition before they actually get pregnant and during pregnancy as well. We actually have a lot of malnutrition around Shaoik. And of course, the pandemic has also made that worse with incomes dropping, etc. Because a lot of nutritional food isn't always readily available. You know, if you're not cooking by yourself, you go out, you buy, you tapao from the shop. Sometimes the food that you eat may look nutritious, but because it's been overcooked or it's been simmering in there, you may have lost some of your nutritional value. That's one. And maternal mental health. I think, you know, we forget about that because studies have shown that when mothers are under stress and have anxiety or depressive symptoms, they may not have been diagnosed with conditions, but they have the symptoms. That, in effect, that can also affect an infant's development.
Would it result in actual anxiety in the infants or the children?
Yes, there's a higher, if you look at longitudinal studies, and one of the studies in our Southeast Asia is from Singapore, the Gusto study, mothers who have anxiety or depressive symptoms are more likely to have children with not just anxiety symptoms, but attention problems, issues with their executive functioning, how they organize themselves in terms of play, how they socialize with other children. And what's interesting is these, despite intervention, these children continue to have difficulties into the school years. Of course, in varying levels of it.
But why is that so, despite the intervention?
So it depends how early intervention is. And remember, intervention is not only because what's been shown as well is maternal mental health, so postnatal mental health as well, affects how you nurture your infants. Right. And so when we talk about intervention, it's not just whether the child receives intervention, but also whether the mother receives intervention. So, you know, it's about nurturing care. It's about attachments between family members and this infant that shapes his brain, so to speak, and develops the right connections. Then we see that actually that helps more than waiting for a problem to arise, diagnosing that problem and sending that child for intervention.
It is a very, very complex situation because, you know, when the issues are sort of starting to pick up in the child, it's adding to what is already probably a stressful environment.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about intervention, but, you know, are interventions necessary for every child who is showing some regression of routines beyond what is typical for their age?
Interventions are, you know, I look at intervention not as outsourcing it to a therapist or someone else to do. I look at interventions as first starting in the home. What can we change at home to help what's going on? Yeah. So, for example, if your child is having issues around sleeping, what can we do? So, let's first look at whether, you know, we're giving our child that exposure to sunlight and actually morning sun. So, in the morning, waking your child up, letting them see the sunshine, going out for a quick walk, or even letting your child play outside if you have a landed property, or getting, you know, allowing sunlight to stream into your house by opening all your windows, your curtains, not tinting everything, that may help before you get on with the rest of the day. And then having that routine before bedtime, yeah, where you do some quiet play for about half an hour to an hour before bedtime, yeah. Having some quiet play, making sure there's no screen time for at least 1 to 2 hours before bedtime. And then maybe bath time, a nice massage, or putting on your baby's lotion, and then having that singing time, or, you know, reading a story, and then falling asleep. That sort of routine may help your child. And it's something that you probably need to do and adjust to yourself. And remember, there are no quick fixes. This takes weeks, days. And if you're talking about adjusting your child's bedtime, if your child sleeps at 11:30, 12, and you want to bring that down, we say do it in, change that routine so it starts 10 minutes earlier every few days. Yeah, not going straight away from 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Yeah, so that's important. And remembering that as a parent, when you're doing these things, your anxiety levels, your stress levels need to be down, because children feed off us. So if you're rushing through everything, that's going to drive up the anxiety for that child. And they're not going to settle down easily. So it's little things like that that make a difference sometimes.
What about the eating?
Yeah. So, you know, with the eating, again, having a pre-meal routine. So we say set your meal times at particular times, and remembering that children, especially toddlers, they eat more frequently, but the quantity drops. So, and you know, milk then becomes a complementary food when they are toddlers. It's more important that they eat, right? And food is then served every 3 to 4 hours, depending on the child. So it starts with breakfast. It's a morning snack, lunch, afternoon tea, dinner, may or may not have supper. Okay. But you have those set times. And before the meal itself, there's a routine. So, okay, mommy's going to get your food. Do you want to come and see? And mom talks through what she's doing, and then washing their hands, getting them to hold their plates, go to the table, sit down. So they're part of that routine, all right? That helps. And when children are fussy, we say get them involved in fruit preparation, get them to wash the vegetables, get them to scoop things into bowls, etc. So, you know, they're smelling and they're handling food beforehand. So their senses are prepared. Yeah, as opposed to you just present the food, sit them on the chair and say, eat.
You know, we also tend to think that, let's say we've gone through this phase and, you know, sort of settled back into routine. And as the kids grow older, especially when they reach primary age, we tend to think it should be sorted and set for life. Is that the case?
No, it's not. And you know, that's why we need parents, right, shall we? Parents are there to help guide us and to set those boundaries and those routines in place. Yeah. Many a time, children will probably be happy to run out of the door without breakfast, but breakfast is one of the most important meals of the day, especially for children who are going into school. So, you know, and then you talk about the adolescent years, they often say, the adolescent years are like the toddler years. It's just that they have mouths and they use words. But, you know, it's with an with a teenager, we know their brain is changing. And so that whole sleep routine changes. And understanding that's important. You know, we know teenagers sleep later, wake up later. But we still got to make sure they get their sleep. Yeah, we don't expect that they're going to go to sleep at 8 o'clock like they did when they were in primary school. But we have to be pretty firm and say, okay, all gadgets off by 10:30 so that you can wind down and be in bed and asleep by 11:30 at the latest, you know, so that if you're waking up at 7:30, you've had enough time to sleep. for your brain to rest.
That doesn't even sound like enough sleep for me as an adult. So I think just as a final word, Dr. Rajini, it really comes back to, you know, knowing individually, you know, where your child is at and setting your expectations for them. It's really so hard, though. We know it in theory. In practice, it's a lot messier. Perhaps a final word on how to balance what we can do right to nurture the habits, but also not over-stressing and over-worrying and then taking it out on the child.
Yeah, I think, you know, firstly, it's important for parents to understand what normal development is. Secondly, it's important for parents to work out what works for them, knowing what is expected in terms of what the child needs, yeah, in terms of basic needs. We're talking about basic needs here today. Sleep, eating, because, you know, all this contributes to anxiety as well. You know, the type of play you need to expose your child to, etc. I think it's also very important for us to understand that really we cannot have children fitting into our routines, yeah. It's hard. I know it's hard, but sometimes we have to make those changes and those sacrifices because these are little beings whose brains are so sensitive to what is happening to them and around them. And if we don't get it right when they're young, there are going to be repercussions later and it's going to be harder. Yeah. I always say this to soon-to-be parents. When you have your first child, say goodbye to your sleep. And, you know, say goodbye to things that you enjoyed on your own, you know, at least for a period of time. Because if you get it right in the first few years, it's easier then to you know, reset things when things go wrong in the school age and the teenage years itself.
Say goodbye to your sleep.
Yes. Yes. Because if you think about it, you know, a baby doesn't come out of the womb and think, I only need to eat every 3 hours. That baby is being fed continuously through the umbilical cord, right, shall we? And so to come out and expect that you're going to sleep for 3 hours and then feed your baby is a no-no for me. You know, so those are the expectations. Yeah.
And I think sometimes these parenting help stuff, you know, sometimes helpful, but sometimes setting very unrealistic expectations for the rigidity that they recommend. So I think it really does come back to what works best for you and just knowing that you can do it in your own way to reach what your child needs.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rajini. I've been speaking to Dr. Rajini Savarnandan, consultant, developmental pediatrician. This has been Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.